Morning.
Good morning.
So this morning I'd like to begin with a quote by Buddha from the Pali Canon, and I'll quote him a few times this morning. Monks, I'm not sure if this is in your program or not, probably. Monks are these things which are constantly changing the self. Are the changing sense experiences of body, the self? Are the changing feelings and perceptions, the self? Are the changing thoughts and mental formations, the self? Are the changing states of consciousness, the self? All these are found to be selfless. So, if I ask you how you are doing this morning, who's the you who's going to answer that? Is it the changing sense experiences your body's had this morning? Is that the you? Is it the changing feelings and perceptions that you've been having just when you since you walked in here and you saw all these people? Is it the changing thoughts and mental formations that you had when you got up this morning? You thought, oh, should I come here at all? Is it the changing states of consciousness? What is the self? And according to our teaching, the self is created by identification. We identify with certain components of our experience. We tie them all together, and we call it ourselves. It's an important convention, important and necessary convention. Purely fiction. Very important. Both. Both. So, when my first teacher was with my friend Sheridan years ago, and she came in for one-to-one with him during a retreat, and she was having a hard time, he said to her, which realm are you in this morning? And we had just been studying. We had just been studying the six realms. And which realm are you in this morning? And which realm are we in this morning? Are we, maybe we've been in all six, maybe we did them in six times in all six this morning. So we've been in the hell realm? Have we really been bummed out about something this morning? Have we been needy this morning in the hungry ghost realm? Wanting more friends, hoping we can have enough courage to stay for social hour even though it's so jammed and maybe talk to someone? Needy. Have we been in the animal realm? Anticipating some choice morsel of food or a choice new a new partner in our lives? Right? In the animal realm, craving. Have we been focused on beating others out this morning? The fighting spirit realm? Beating others out? Being the best meditator? Being more still than others? I know this one pretty well. Or have we been totally confident? Perfect. Wow. God realm, right? How long does that last? I'm told that lasts the shortest period of time. That's what I'm told. Actually, I know that from experience. So the less we cling to our ideas of self or identify with a specific realm, the freer and happier we become. It just happens. So I had a friend named Marge, and here's a little chronological thing I wrote up about Marge over a period of, this must have been 20 years. So Marge has a daughter. She's excited and involved in her daughter's life and beauty. She's a good mother. I'm a good mother. Her daughter in college has a psychotic break, and Marge feels awful because she knows she's a bad mother, and she starts drinking. Everybody tells her she's responsible. She knows she's responsible. She's a bad mother. She goes into therapy. She's in therapy for, that does 100 sessions of therapy. The therapist tells her, her daughter's psychotic break and her schizophrenia has nothing to do with her. It's a brain disease. She becomes an effective, self-satisfied mental health advocate, feeling that she's a good person, creating meaningful change. Her youngest son gets kicked out of college for using drugs. Her husband leaves her for her best friend. She is an awful mother and an awful wife and an awful human being. Her daughter with schizophrenia gives birth to an adorable baby. This all happened, you guys. This all happened. This stuff is all happening all the time. If it happened to me, it happened to you. Unless you just totally zoned out. Her daughter with schizophrenia gives birth to an adorable baby whom they parent together. She's a filled-up, happy, fulfilled grandmother. Wow, wow. That's who she is. And then we can end on the negative or the positive. Well, let's land on the negative, because you guys need a good downer. You seem too happy. Her daughter goes off her meds, has paranoid delusions, and runs off with a child. Who is she then? Who is she then? So who are we? Who are we in the midst of all these roles? Are we our ideas? Are we our thoughts? Are we our concerns? Are we our stories? Or are we the stuff that underlies those, the extended feelings, the moods, the instinctual urges that underlie all that stuff we say to ourselves? And of course, meditation is about seeing these layers, of roles that we identify with. That the layer in which the talking layer and then the more subliminal layer, seeing them and seeing through them so they break up. Just like I'm waiting for this ice to break up off the lake. It seemed like the other day it was going to break up. Then I started anticipating it, and it whenever we start anticipating it, it freezes harder, right? Freezes harder. I was ecstatic 8 days ago. It was breaking up. So you want your meditation to improve, and you get ecstatic about it. You create a new layer. It's your layer of, oh boy, I've got it now. Who is the you who's got it? Who is the you? The you that you attach to is the ice on the lake. That's the ice. It's the same water. It's water. It's the water of life. It's the water of being. The water includes all kinds of fish and algae and paper cups. Boy, our lake has a lot of paper cups these days, right now at this time of year. But that's what's in the lake. But we need to do a meditation practice and see the eyes. See the more superficial layer of eyes, which is all the stuff we talk about. And then underneath, the mood, the affect, the drive, the need. If we see that stuff in our meditation, we begin to experience the flow of the water that's always, always there, always present, regardless of whether it's January 1st or May 1st or June 1st. So I had a friend named Sydney, a woman named Sydney, who was a Vipassana meditator. Sydney's not here anymore. She died a few years ago. So Sydney, I was pretty close with, and Sydney had a stroke. And I went over to see her after her stroke, and she was living in her house. And I was told that she'd lost her ability to talk. She couldn't talk anymore. But she'd been a good friend of mine and a supporter of mine, and a friend in meditation. You know, I talk about this over and over again, but we need a friend in our to meditate with us, because meditation is not easy. We need a friend. Just one friend is good enough. One friend so we can share our stuff that comes up and the stuff we feel we're not doing good enough. You can come see the teacher too, but you don't really want to tell the teacher the stuff that's... If you can do that with a teacher, cool, but usually you can't, because you want to be on your best behavior when you come up to see the teacher. But if you have a friend, you can be on your worst behavior, because you guys are struggling together. You're struggling together to look at this ice, to appreciate this ice and to let it melt, seeing that it's the same as the water underneath. So Sydney was my friend. And in a way still is my friend. Don't want to get mystical about it, but in a way she still is my friend. So I went over to see Sydney at her house in North Oaks. And how I got to have a friend in North Oaks is another issue. Another question. But I have one friend in North Oaks. No, I have none. I went over to see Sydney at her house in North Oaks. And so she greeted me at the door, and she had someone living there with her. And then she wrote, can't talk, handshakes. Her hand was shaking as she was writing. That's okay. Learned. Not this. I'm not this voice. Learned, not this body. And then I looked at her, and her eyes were just penetrating with affection and love. So who is she? Who was she? Not this voice, not this body. Affectionate eyes, is that who she is? What about when she lost her eyes? Who are we? Who are we? So, as many of you know, I like to lead long retreats, and I like to lead long retreats not because I'm a masochist or a sadist. I think some people think that's why I like to do it, because I used to be a masochist and now I'm a sadist. Neither are the case. Neither are the case. Although I may have those tendencies. We all have some of those tendencies, don't we? I like to lead long retreats because, as I've been saying, often in the first day of retreat, we're just monkey-minded all over the place. It's just a day of monkey mind. And the second day, we might begin to turn to calm down, but often it's not till around the third or fourth day that we begin to really experience the layers of ice, and without wanting to mess with them, and just let them be and let them start to melt. So anyway, a student, I don't know if she was my student, I guess she was my student, I don't know. A student came up to see me a few years ago on the third day, and she said, I said, how's your meditation been going? She said, well, I think it's been going well because I've been experiencing a lot of space, but it's kind of scary. Who will I be if I lose myself? How will I be in the world? I think maybe I should go home now. This happens in meditation. When you finally get to start calming down, whether it's the second hour or the second day or the fourth hour or the fourth day, who will I be in this world? Who am I? I can't identify with a space. There's nothing here. So she was scared. She was scared. And this is natural. This is natural. It's part of the whole process. Part of the whole process. So somehow she stayed, or encouraged her to stay, and I don't remember that part. Then on the fifth day or something, she came up to see me again after a very quiet sitting. She said, I had a very quiet sitting, and this time she was very peaceful when she came into my office. And she said, when the impulse came to get up, the body rose and got up all by itself. Did you know that your body, without you doing anything, can get up all by itself? Who is the you then when your body just gets up? Who is the body? Who is the you then when your body just walks out of the zendo? Who is the you when you just start talking to someone? Who is the you? So we have the potential of letting go of this small, constrained self through two complementary components of meditation. One is the stabilizing component, concentration, which leads to equanimity. And the second is the arousing component, effort, investigation, questioning, which leads to clear seeing. Stabilizing component. With patience and courage, we sit still without running. We sit firmly without running. We see endless mental stories, but we don't run. We let them go, and if they don't go, we let them be. And we return to the present. We return to our what we're doing, our object of concentration in meditation, or our activity, whatever we're doing in our daily lives. Sometimes we feel the flood of emotion underneath. Sometimes we feel that instinctual urges to get a bite of food. It's interesting, it doesn't happen to me anymore, but I used to get all kinds of food imagery on about the third day of meditation. I just wanted something comfort food. Just some comfort food. If I can't have ice cream, how about yogurt? If I can't have yogurt, maybe I can sneak into the kitchen and just have a teaspoon of peanut butter. Oh, a teaspoon of peanut butter will solve everything. Anybody ever had any of these urges? And I still have them, you know. I'm not saying any of this stuff goes away. No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm not making that claim. And we can begin, though, to clearly see this stuff and clearly see the patterns that tie it all together. The patterns of behavior, the patterns of thinking, the patterns of feeling that tie it all together. So here's another quote from Buddha in the Pali Canon, where he discusses his own fears. I don't know if it's in there. In the dark of the month with no moon, I entered the most strange and frightening place in the thick of the forest, so that I might understand fear and terror. And being resolved to dispel that hold of fear and terror, I remained in whatever posture it arose, sitting, walking, or lying down. I did not change until I had faced that fear and terror in the very posture. By facing the fear and terror, I became free. I became free. So whatever you experience, you have can be your teacher. That experience is your teacher. If you just stay with it. If you just stay with it. So there was a woman whom I used to sit with named Lenore. And Lenore had asthma. And she didn't know about doing retreats with her asthma. Because she had trouble breathing and she had to use one of those, what do you call those things, inhalers? Katagiri Roshi, the founding teacher here, encouraged her to stay, encouraged her to put her inhaler right down next to her in the cushion and said it was okay for her to move to get her inhaler. She needed it. Well, that's good, isn't it? We don't want to be too rigid about these forms. If we are, then we get frozen. So, pick up the inhaler when she needed it. Pick up in the inhaler. But also, he said, stay for the whole retreat. Stay for all 7 days. This was a 7-day retreat. And as many times as you need to use the inhaler, just use it. And use the stress of your breathing, the stress in your throat muscles, as your meditation. Make that your meditation. Be with it. Be with it. Knowing that you have the inhaler that you can pick up at any time, because we don't want to be foolish, but just to be with it, just to be with it. And she noticed by the end of this retreat that her throat muscles were really relaxing. Now her breath was not so shallow. By facing the fear and terror, we become free. Now, we want to become free right away. I'm sorry. It's not. You really have to go through it. I don't know how long it'll take. Kind of depends on your karma, I guess. Your ancient twisted karma or something like that. Your habits, your past, what you're carrying around with you. Depends on that. Anywhere in the thick of the forest, that's where you find your freedom. In the thick of the forest. So stabilizing through concentration meditation leads to equanimity. And here's Buddha again from the Pali Canon. It is through the cultivation of inner concentration that the luminous purity of mind arises. It is through luminous purity that access to expanded states arise. It is from the profound concentration of samadhi that liberating insight is revealed. And there's a bursting of the boundary between the self and the cosmos. There's a bursting of the division between the ice and the water. There's still ice, but it's water. There's still water, and sometimes it's ice. Sometimes it's bubbles. Sometimes it's spray. Sometimes it's just sedentary. Just still. The bursting of the boundary. So when I was a young man, many years ago, it's getting longer ago than it used to be. When I was a young man, I took LSD twice. LSD twice. It was wonderful. It was wonderful because I did it in a very prepared environment. I wasn't foolish like these kids that did it in rock concerts and just in moving cars. I did it with spiritual objects around. I did Zazen first. I had my wife there giving me meals, all that stuff. Because setting is the whole deal, both for meditation and for... Well, I better not get into drugs now. But it's the whole thing. The whole thing, setting. But I only took it twice because I had neither the training nor the understanding to deal with those states without openness. I had. And none of us did. None of us did. We didn't have the training or the understanding to deal with those states. This is about changing our own biochemistry, not through ingesting a chemical, but through being with what is. And of course, concentration meditation is not that big a deal because you have to concentrate to accomplish anything. You have to concentrate. Athletes, being in the zone, being in flow, all that stuff. Concentration is key, right? It's key. Artists and lots of dancers, right? Dancers, musicians. So I'll remember Phil Jackson. Who remembers Phil Jackson? Raise your hand if you remember Phil Jackson. Not that many of you remember Phil Jackson. You don't follow basketball. A lot of people don't follow basketball. I don't follow basketball either, but I follow Phil Jackson. So Phil Jackson, who is a basketball player himself with North Dakota, South Dakota, I think college, and then a pro basketball player, and then he became a coach, and of course he was a Zen Buddhist, he was a meditator. So some of you guys know this, right? I thought this was sort of common knowledge. So when he took over first he did the Chicago Bulls, and then he had the LA Lakers. So when he took over the Chicago Bulls, he hired George Mumford, the Buddhist meditation teacher, to work with his players. Remember that? He's from Chicago.
Yeah.
You were in Chicago.
Yep.
During those years, right?
Yeah.
He hired George Mumford. And George Mumford said there was only one player on the Chicago Bulls and then the L.A. Lakers, whom George Mumford followed Phil Jackson to the L.A. Lakers, who didn't need the concentration meditation. Who is that?
Michael Jordan.
Michael Jordan. Because he was so concentrated. He was so in the flow. He didn't need it. But we're not all Michael Jordans. Very few of us are Michael Jordans. 0.1% of us are Michael Jordans, right? We need it. And the interesting thing about Michael Jordan is that Michael Jordan originally wasn't a very good basketball player. He wasn't in high school. He was not a very good basketball player. In college, he got cut from the varsity team. Do you know that? But he was so concentrated and so into it that it didn't matter. So examples of concentration in meditation. Four examples. Metta, loving kindness. Do loving kindness meditation. Do lots of it. Do it continually. Fill up your consciousness with loving kindness for yourself, for your family, for the worms and bugs that are crawling around, for the people you hate, for foreigners, for people in the Tea Party. Everybody. Concentration meditation. Following your breathing. That's standard Zen meditation. Concentration meditation. Just surf the breathing. Sometimes the surf's up, sometimes the surf's still. Doesn't matter. Concentration is not altering. It's being with. Being with. Just surf the breathing. Mantra meditation. Mantra meditation is cool. Lots of people who come to Zen Center used to do, what was this?
Transcendental meditation.
Yeah, transcendental meditation. Well, still do transcendental meditation. Cool, do it. Do it. Don't get wigged out about it. Just do it. It's a good meditation. Repeat something over to yourself. If it helps you, just be here. Repeat it. You can do some sacred mantra, or you can make up your own sacred mantra, or something in between. One of Thich Nhat Hanh's gathas, or your own gatha. Concentration meditation. Your immediate environment while you're sitting. While you're sitting. The cars on the street, the birds, the voices, just the sounds. Just focusing on the sounds. And you develop the ability, believe it or not, you develop the ability to release these distractions, these physical tensions, these memories, these fears, and come back to the object of your meditation. Until at some point, nothing distracts you. And this is where Buddha says that it's from the profound concentration of samadhi that liberating insight is revealed. This is true. This is not something... It's something you can all experience. You can all do this. And this results in a disillusion of the patterns of conditioning. And when I say disillusion, I don't mean they go away forever. I just mean that you see through them and you see around them. We have our conditioning till we die. We have our habits. We have our childhood fears. Till we die. But we can see through them. We can see beyond them. They cannot create... They don't have to create this heaviness, this density. If we have this extra weight. We may weigh 140 pounds, but with the extra weight, we weigh 300 pounds. Whoa. Carrying this weight around. Whoa. But we can come back to our 140-pound stealth. Maybe 141 pounds, because we do, you know, some concerns and worries. A little bit of worry and concern is actually healthy. Actually help it. Just a little bit, you know? So the first component of meditation then is stabilizing concentration. And the second component is arousing. Suzuki Roshi, my teacher, used to talk about arousing the way-seeking mind. Aspiration. Michael Jordan had the basketball-seeking mind. Why did he become the best player? Well, he wasn't any good. He had the basketball-seeking mind. How about the way-seeking mind? Not just basketball, but the way, the Tao. The way, which includes the ice and the water, always interpenetrating, always moving together, always changing. Beauty in that ice and that water, even in the polluted part. If you really look in, it's beautiful. It's beautiful. Colors, transforming, changing. So the arousing is important. Arousing the way-seeking mind so that we can deeply look while we're meditating. We can question who this self is. It thinks its meditation isn't getting anywhere. It has pain in the leg. It's feeling like, I got the samadhi now. Wait, can't wait till I tell Tim. So we put our effort into our meditation as we do it to other things that we're committed to, as if our life depends on it. Maybe our life does depend on it. Maybe it does. We really want to live. Maybe we need to break through those layers of ice so we can feel the water, so we can enjoy the whole lake. The whole lake, and not just be caught on the top of the ice, struggling all the time. So this is a practice of looking, listening, and asking. Arousing the way-seeking mind. Looking, listening, and asking. When your meditation is stuck, who is this you that's stuck? Is it your body that's stuck? Is it your feelings that are stuck? Is it your mind? Or is it what you're saying about all that stuff that's stuck? What is it? Who's stuck? Go into it. Look at it. Look at it. Wonderful. Wonderful. So in my body, I'm feeling numbness. I have permanent numbness in two of my toes, I guess. I've been doing physical therapy for 2 years and special exercises every day, but I just seem to have this numbness. I guess it's for the rest of my life from a back injury. Who is the eye that's stuck? Is it your body? Is it my feelings about the numbness? Because I'm feeling that I'll never get anywhere through the numbness. I'm just going to give up and forget this whole thing or something. Of course, I'm the teacher here, so well, I could sit in a chair. But still the numbness is there. I could stand on my head, but still the numbness is there. So, there you go. There you go. Who is this? Who's stuck? Is it my patterns? Are they really mine? Is this numbness really mine? Is this boredom really mine? I'm bored. I'm bored with this numbness. This numbness is extending to my whole body and my whole mind. I'm just bored sitting here. This is the third day of retreat, and I'm just... can't wait to get out of here. It's so boring. Right? Everything's numb. Everything's numb. So what does this boredom turn into as you look into it? Is it annoyance? Is annoyance underneath the boredom? I'm annoyed that I have to sit here facing this wall for 40 minutes. That's annoying when I've got lots to do at home and a house at least not. So underneath the boredom, all the boredom is annoying. Or maybe I go back to the boredom. That's more fun than the annoying, right? But if you go deeper, you see the annoying, you see the anger, you see the fear. Can you do that? Do you have the courage to do that? In the right environment? With people who care about you? With people who are there for you? With religious figures and spiritual guides to support you? With your teachers all around you? We carry our teachers, our lineage with us. My teacher, I carry him with me. I don't have to carry him. He carries himself. I feel so fortunate. Our teachers are here. Our teachers are here. So is this my fear? Is it my boredom? How do these stories about my fear and my boredom tie the whole thing together? How do they tie the whole thing together? Maybe they don't tie it together. Maybe they just shred it. Oh, how do they shred it all? Look, listen, ask. Look, listen, ask. So if we do this meditation, it bears fruits. And people complain to me sometimes that it doesn't bear fruits soon fast enough. Sorry. What can I say? Sorry. But if we do this practice, there will be fruits of our concentration and our arousing meditation. It will bear fruit. It bears fruit. What's the point of doing it if it won't bear fruit? It will when it does. Nobody has ancient twisted karma that is so zonked out that they can't do this. Nobody. So what are the fruits of this dissolving the ice into the water? Dissolving the differentiation between the ice and the water. What are the fruits? Well, I'm suggesting today there are three fruits. First is clear seeing. We see things more clearly. We see people more clearly without the screen. We're able to let go of the screen of filtering through our thoughts, through our memories, through our past, through our hopes, through our fears. We let go of the screen. We have clear seeing. What this reminds me of this morning, since I'm having, I guess, a wave of nostalgia these days, is The Who. and Peter Townsend. And the song, I Can See for Miles and Miles and Miles. I can see for miles and miles and miles. Even people like you young guys, maybe you know that, don't you? It's a pretty famous Who song. Pretty famous. And you know, when Pete Townsend wrote that song, he had just taken LSD. And he had a wonderful opening. He'd had a lot of personal travails, and the song talks about his personal travails. And a lot of sadness, a lot of heartbreak. But then, I can see for miles and miles and miles. He saw beyond it. He saw through it. He saw beyond it. And then, about a year later, he forswore taking drugs ever again, and he became a disciple of Mirabhavas. And that's because he saw that the LSD had not changed. He wasn't any nicer to his friends. He wasn't any nicer to his wife. He wasn't any nicer to himself. It had been a temporary chemical change in his brain, and which he was then kind of arrogant about. But he had still written that song. It gave him the opening to write that song, and it gave him the opening to become a disciple of Mirabhava. Most of us who were the original Zen people, I don't know if we were original, but you know, I'm 71 years old, and I started practicing Zen 51 years ago in San Francisco. So, you know, there weren't too many of us then. We started by taking acid. 90% of us started by taking acid. There'd be no Zen Center here in Minneapolis if a bunch of us hadn't taken acid. It's just true. That's our history. You know, no point in hiding it. Although I did used to be one of hiding, but not anymore. My friends used to drop acid before sessions would start. I'm going to take 400 milligrams before that. Oh, I'm going to do 2 days and then take another 400. I thought, no. No, I won't get into that. So clear seeing. You'll be able to see for miles and miles and miles. You are, innately. You can see for miles and miles and miles. It's just this stuff that clogs things up, that makes you hard to see. But this stuff is fabricated stuff. It's made up stuff. Clear seeing. So we practice clear seeing. We practice looking, listening, and asking so that we can manifest clear seeing. So that it becomes natural. But it's no longer a technique out there. And the second fruit is resilience. You learn to roll with the punches. You learn to easily move your focus from sitting to walking, from looking to eating, to going to the bathroom, to doing whatever. Resilience. And the third fruit is empathy. Empathy. You develop empathy, because when you let go of all this stuff, You feel people's pain more, just more naturally, without having to try to solve it. You just feel it, and you're empathic, and you want to help them. So compassion comes out of this. It's a byproduct of this. It's a byproduct of this. But empathy. So as a result of doing this, who are we? Or who are we before we start doing this? Or who are we in the beginning? In a way, our identity changes. We don't kick out the small self. The small self's still here. Tim is as needy as ever. He wants everybody to like his talks. He wants everybody to come. He counts the number of people who come to his talks. Ted's talks. And if more people come to Ted's talks, then he doesn't want Ted for the assistant guiding teacher anymore. He's always counting. That's little Tim. That's little needy Tim. Till death do us part. It's true. So if you expect to transcend that, don't do Zen, do some other religion. And good luck. Good luck. But your identity becomes more fluid. There's more clear seeing of your patterns. There's more ability just to, when you get knocked down, just to get up. Get knocked down, get up. Make a mistake, apologize. Just apologize. Don't carry it around. Apologize wholeheartedly. And to be more sensitive to the pains of others. To be more sensitive without getting wigged out by those pains. There's nothing to get wigged out about. That's just your stuff that's trying to solve them. We can't solve all this pain. We're in pain. There's a lot of pain. But we can do stuff about it. First we need to be empathic, and then we need to act. We need to choose areas where we think we can really be helpful. Can we really be helpful with racial issues? Is that an area that we really want to choose in our higher hearts, knowing that there are all white people in here, and that 70% of African-American men will be in prison at some point, have been in prison at some point, due to the drug war. That's what the drug war did. What did the drug war do? It enslaved 70% of the African-American population. And it's done in a covert way, not an overt way. When there was just slavery, it was either easy. You've got me onto this, Jeff.
I guess I did.
Anyway, that's just an example. We can do stuff. We can do stuff, but we have to practice for meditation. Feel the empathy and do something. And we can't do everything, but we can do something. So I think that's what I want to say. It's about 1:45, so 5-10 minutes of questions or comments.
Mm-hmm. I have a question.
Sure.
You're a therapist professionally, correct?
Oh, well, I have been a therapist professionally.
Okay. How do you, seeing clearly in all this, it all to me seems very useful. And I think it helps decouple you from your patterns and your emotions. But sometimes you have to do the hard work of introspection and untangling yourself and all of that. So how do you kind of view sort of that, maybe those kind of two things, like the meditation and the focus with this kind of more problem-solving, tactical side to working on yourself?
Well, you just do both, that's all. You just do both. So I don't say there's a how. Do both. I'm not a therapist anymore. I'm a Zen teacher. But I encourage people to be in therapy when they need it. Many people do need it at many times in their lives. In a way, Zen meditation can be a kind of therapy, but many people benefit from talk therapy in addition to this bare awareness of Zen. And they can be wonderful complements of one another. But how do you do it? You just do it. They integrate on their own, especially if you're working with a therapist who has a meditative orientation. Or you're working with a Zen teacher who has a therapeutic. Or both. Does that make sense?
Yeah. In the talk, you talk about the seeking mind.
The way seeking mind?
Yeah. And if I said, okay, today I need to get into seeking mind, so how do I start?
Oh, you want to get into the way seeking mind, where do you start? You have to start by being hungry. You have to start by being profoundly dissatisfied with yourself and the world. That's where you start. With great spiritual hunger. And if you don't have great spiritual hunger, then you're not ready. Does that make sense? Do you want me to ask me something more about that?
I'm good.
Oh, okay.